finishes off in style. A magnificent strike into the crowd. India lift the World Cup after 28 years.
...176 and 127, 215, 350 in 66 tests, 36 sixes in one test. Numbers don't really tell the full story when it comes to cricket, but the numbers I just mentioned at the top of this show, well, they too tell the story of India's first test against South Africa in Visakhapatnam, which ended on Sunday. India won by 203 runs, took a 1-0 lead in the three-match series. Twin hundreds from Rohit Sharma, Mayank Agarwal's double hundred, R. Ashwin's triumphant comeback, Mohammad Shami's second innings blast. Despite counter-attacking hundreds from Dean Elgar and Quinton de Kock, South Africa collapsed and folded up to concede defeat. Hello and welcome to this episode of Hotspot. I am Chetan Narula with Deep Das Gupta. And joining us all the way from Cape Town, we have South Africa's eminent cricket writer, Telford Weiss. Say hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hi, guys, and welcome, Telford, to the podcast. This is your debut. This is our second episode, so yeah, warm welcome to you.
Thanks very much. I hope to make as good a debut with a bat as Sinaram Mutasami did.
Well, he did delay the inevitable for South Africa. And today on the show, we'll be talking about that aspect, his selection, and a lot more. So we're going to talk about various pointers from this first test match. We'll try and take it day by day because there's a lot to talk about and we have a very concise show. So we'll talk about Rohit Sharma and Mayank Agarwal, who set about that 317-run partnership, a record third-highest opening stand for India, and the ninth opening partnership since July 2017. On day two, South Africa, well, they perhaps paid the price of not playing a third pacer as India marched towards a 500-plus score.
And then we do obviously talk about day three and four, where South Africa counterattacked despite losing their top order. Is this the template for teams visiting India now? I mean, being gritty and you know, not giving up hope till the last moment?
And then we move on talking a little more about Rohit Sharma and if he's answered sufficient questions about the opening spot at present. And last but not the least, we'll talk about the second innings collapse from South Africa, Shami, and we'll be looking ahead to the second test in Pune. Before we go ahead, though, we'll mention that Telford, well, he was in London for a while and then he visited Turkey as well. And to all our listeners, you must follow Telford, not only on Twitter, but also on Instagram. He has the most wonderful pictures. Thanks once again for joining us and looking forward to this discussion. Well, Rohit Sharma as opener in the first test match. I mean, it doesn't really get better than this, does it? 176, 127, 300, in two innings, average of 150. For someone whose career average never went above 40 in 30-odd tests, and then overseas test average was less than 30, in home conditions, it can be a given that he would score runs, but 200s in two innings, a very select group of Indian batsmen, Sunil Gavaskar done it thrice, Vijay Hazare, Rahul Dravid twice, you have Virat Kohli and Ajinkya Rahane. Deep, were you surprised by what happened?
I'm not surprised at all. But what was heartening to see is the way he approached it. The first half an hour, 45 minutes, as the cliche goes, you give it to the bowlers. That's exactly what Rohit did. Then he opened up after the first hour or so. And what was heartening to see is the change in his batting technique and his mental discipline. I think that was really good to see because, you know, a lot of people have compared him to someone like Viru. But we've got to remember Viru, we spoke about it before. He was 25 when he came in as an opener. But this guy is an established white ball player. He's 32, 33. But for him to change his technique, which would suit red ball cricket, just tells me that he's serious about it. He wants to give it a really, really good shot, even if that means sacrificing a bit of his white ball cricket. And that is heartening to see.
Well, for me, the interesting bit was that he took his time. I mean, we had that spell from Vernon Philander at the beginning where the ball was just nipping around a bit. And I think this test match was all about the hard new ball. And that's perhaps going to be to be what the series is going to be about, really. What the bowlers can do with the hard new ball, because the softer ball, it really becomes tough to stop that scoring. He showed restraint and then just went after when the spinners came on. Very quickly, want to bring in Telford here. Telford, you know, you had 4 overs from Vernon Philander, 4 overs from Kagiso Rabada, and the 9th over, you had Keshav Maharaj coming on in a test match in India, which wasn't surprising, really. But then you also have Dane Pate, and you had Senuran Muthusami. Surprised there that 3 pacers South Africa chose to go with?
I don't think surprising, really. You know, it's South Africa at the moment are kind of, I know it didn't look like it in this test match, perhaps, but they're a bit, they're not too sure what to do with all the spin talent, which has suddenly arrived. And you know, that isn't often the case in South Africa, that they do have that many spinners to choose from. And I said it, maybe it doesn't look like it because, you know, Dane Pate particularly, and Muthusami, he's on debut, bowled well enough, but probably, you know, it didn't look as if South Africa was sending 3 top-class spinners in there. Keshav Maharaj, certainly from a South African perspective, has proven himself. Dane Pate did not bowl well. I don't think that's too, you know, that's the only way you can say he didn't bowl terribly well. It wasn't surprising. No, I don't think. Yeah.
Can I jump in, Telford?
Yeah.
Sorry, just a question for you. From my perspective, I thought it was a little negative, you know, going in with 3 spinners, even though I understand you're playing in the subcontinent where you expect the ball to turn. But don't you think you would rather depend on your strength, which predominantly is fast bowling, and you have somebody like Nokia or Lungengiri who've got raw pace, you know, 140 plus. And also the fact that Dane Pate started bowling very early in his spell round the wicket with a newish ball very early in his spell. Don't you? I mean, I found it kind of negative. Would you agree?
Yeah, I suppose you could call it negative. I think everything about this test match, however, is South Africa will see in light of what happened in 2015. Right. You know, I remember in 2015 when Faf du Plessis was not then the captain, Hashim Amla was, walked in 2 days before the Mohali test match, right at the beginning of the series. And the look on his face and what he said was, he sounded like a man who'd lost a war, you know, and the series hadn't even started. And I think that really coloured the way South Africa approached this series. It doesn't help that they had a poor World Cup. I know it's a different format, but, you know, obviously that has an impact on how they're approaching things here. And, of course, it doesn't help that they've had retirements, they've had just about a new coaching staff in there. So I think their approach would have been tentative going into this series. And yes, I suppose it does look negative, it does look defensive, but there's an awful lot of new thinking in South African cricket right now. And there's space, there's space and opportunity for people to come with new ideas, which, yeah, absolutely, from another angle, will look negative and will look defensive. And I think that is what's happening, and we saw that on the field in this match.
Okay, I'll tell you what the problem with the 3-pacer thing is. Yes, it might look negative, but that's a new direction for South Africa, as rightly put by Telford. And perhaps, like you said, it was not all that surprising, because if you're not going to play 3 spinners in India, where else are you going to play them when you have so much spin talent? My point here, or my problem here is, first of all, let's come to Rohit Sharma and Mayank Agarwal. They were tight in the first 10 overs, and then as soon as the spinners come on, you start taking runs very quickly off those spinners. So, like you said, that Dane Pate bowled badly, and that's the best way to put it. So you have Keshav Maharaj, who's going at 3 per over. You have Senuran Muthusami, who's playing his first test, playing for the first time in India. He's going at 4 and over. So that's 7 runs of 12 balls that's taken against 2 spinners. And then you have Dane Pate bowling, and he is going for 6 and over. So basically, from in test cricket, you want your bowlers to bowl in pairings, one end tight, attack from the other end. When you play 3 spinners, you basically give away that control. And with the 2 pacers bowling short spells, you never get that attacking rhythm going. And Mayank Agarwal and Rohit Sharma really made that count with 317 runs the opening partnership. That's the problem. What do you think? First Deep and then Telford.
Okay, my take is the fact that the bowling is inexperienced and it showed. Because on a slowish strike like one at Vizag, it's very important to get the pace right and the length right. You'd see a lot of balls being cut, whether it's Dan Peet or whether it's Keshav Maharaj, because it's difficult to find the right length, and especially on a slower surface where you really have to be a little fuller. And once you start bowling fuller and you're slow in the air, then the batsman starts stepping out and then you start bowling short. So I think it's lack of experience as well with the spinning attack, which showed, which is, for me, was quite evident. You know, they were a little slower in the air, which is fine when you're bowling in South Africa because the pitches itself, they have pace and bounce. But these surfaces here in India, there isn't enough pace and bounce. So you will have to bowl a little more flatter and quicker, giving less time to the batsman. And I think that's where they will learn from the first test match. And I'm sure in the second test match, they'll try and bowl a little quicker and flatter.
Telford, how about you? I mean, no really attacking pairing for South Africa in this test.
No, not really. And, you know, when you talk about experience, well, you know, Norkia is as inexperienced as somebody like Dan Pittu, who, of course, hasn't played a test in a while. And as we said, Mutisam is on debut. And, of course, Lungi Ngidi is coming back from injury. He's also pretty inexperienced. And both of those bowlers, Norkia and Ngidi, they're express pace bowlers. They come at you and they let fly. You know, there's a lot of nuance involved there. Whereas there is with Philander and even somebody like Rabada has learnt a few tricks in his still fairly young test career. So I think South Africa pretty much between a rock and a hard place. What do? We have two experienced fast bowlers in Philander and Rabada, but then after that, it's much of a muchness, really. And if you're going to have to choose in terms of the conditions, I can see how they got there to put in the three spinners. The problem was two of the three spinners didn't bowl very well. So you know, that doesn't help. And the one who did bowl reasonably well, I mean, he was pretty much a workhorse. You know, nobody's bowled more than 55 overs in a test innings for South Africa ever. And Maharaj did that. And so they were a bit stuck.
Yeah, well, in a way, if you play three spinners in India, and of course, if Rohit Sharma gets going in his first innings as opener, you tend to play into India's hands. And that was a wonderful partnership, 317. From there onwards, South Africa really on the back foot. 176 for Rohit Sharma, as I mentioned, in the first innings. 215 for Mayank Agarwal. Deep, it's been a wonderful story since Australia for a young Mayank. Really, that, you know, really shows that the rigors of Ranji Trophy domestic cricket
absolutely
not really lost.
Chetan, absolutely. I'm so happy because he's one of those guys who've done his miles, who've put in his hours in domestic cricket. Somebody who made his debut back in 2013. And mind you, he played for India under 19 in 2010. So it wasn't straight away from under 19 to Ranji Trophy and 2 years of Ranji Trophy in the Indian side. He's actually served his time in domestic cricket and mind you, he wasn't a regular even for the Karnatakas in the first class side from 2013 to 2016. He was in and out of the squad. It's just 2017. He turned things around in that year. I mean, he scored a 300 beginning of November 2017. And that particular month, the month of November itself, he goes on to score 1,000 first class runs in 1 month. And then total of 2,200 runs in that season. And so I'm so glad that, you know, that our first-class cricket, we don't give it enough emphasis at times. We look at raw talent and say, you know what, this guy has the potential. He's talented. Let's push him into the Indian side. But you know, playing domestic cricket for a few years has its own merits. And I think that should be looked into more seriously.
Well, let me tell you what's going to happen now is because Mayank Agarwal scoring that double 100, he was, you know, he's seen somebody in domestic cricket, also somebody who excels at limited overs cricket, somebody who excels at wide ball cricket, he has all the shots in the book. And I see in the near future, there will be calls made to include him in the ODI arena or the T20 arena. He already does well every year in the IPL for whichever team he plays for. So this is going to be the near future for Mayank Agarwal. It's been a wonderful story. And that brings us to the conclusion of the first couple of days' play. Like I said, it was dominated by India, who put on 500 runs on the board. 502 for 7. South Africa on the back foot ever since that score came on the board. But more than that, more importantly, what happened towards the end of that day too. 39 for 3. Ravichandran Ashwin with that new ball. We'll talk to you about Ravichandran Ashwin and a little bit more about Rohit Sharma as well as South Africa's marvelous fight back.
Let's talk about Ravichandran Ashwin to start off with. Somebody who wasn't part of the playing 11 in West Indies post-Australia series. We heard the team management saying overseas number one spinner is Kuldeep Yadav. Well, I mean, this was kind of a comeback for somebody before this test match had picked up, what, 342 wickets in 65 test matches. Pretty Bradman-esque. And in this test match, he completed 350 wickets. I mean, equaling the fastest ever to do so. So, Ashwin, I mean, listen, now the big question now here is, I don't think his form in India was ever questionable or questioned. It's just the fitness side of things which I thought let the Indian management down when India was traveling predominantly in England and Australia. I mean, Australia, he played the first test match and was injured post that. Even the England series, he played all four test matches, but after the first test match, he wasn't 100% fit, it seems. But, you know, what a comeback for someone like him. I think we would obviously remember this test match for Rohit Sharma and to a certain extent Mayank Agarwal. But I think it was equally important for someone like Ashwin, kind of a comeback or a new lease of life, so to say. So what are your thoughts, gentlemen? Telford, if I start with you and then Chetan.
Yeah, I think, you know, for South Africans who maybe haven't been following Ashwin's career that closely since the 2015 series between India and South Africa in India, where, of course, he was this monster of a bowler and took 31 wickets and was just fantastic and just unplayable a lot of the time. And in terms of presence, as well as what he actually did in physical terms, I think he just was this massive figure for South Africans. He was as big as Mitchell Johnson, you know, in that series in mental terms. But yeah. I think there's an interesting parallel to be drawn between Ashwin and Vernon Philander, who also has been, you know, a demon bowler in South African home conditions, but has also struggled with conditioning. You know, Graham Smith, and talk about pot kettle black. Graham Smith is not the smallest human being in the world, but you know, he's had a lot of goes at Philander for his conditioning. And maybe he has a point, does Graham Smith. And I think, you know, there's a similarity there in that people are frustrated with Vernon Philander and his conditioning, and perhaps they also are with Ashwin. So it's an interesting thing. I mean, I think as a wonderful bowler is Ashwin. I think Vernon Philander is a wonderful bowler in home conditions. And there's you can make some connections there.
Well, it's an interesting point, what Telford really says here, because only, you know, before recording this, I had written a piece about Ashwin, and I was just comparing the statistics of all the major Indian or greatest Indian spinners that we have, starting from the 70s, Bishan Bedi, Erappally Prasanna, Bhagwat Chandrasekhar, you have Harbhajan Singh, Anil Kumble, Ravindra Jadeja now also climbing that chart with his excellent performances everywhere. And what surprises me is when you compare all their strike rates and averages overseas test cricket, Ashwin has done the best. Like, he has 4 wickets per overseas match. His average is the highest. His strike rate is second best after Bhagwat Chandrasekhar. So, you know, and these are all spinners who've played more than 20, 25 overseas test matches. So that's a healthy amount of cricket. But when it comes to public discourse, or when it comes to, you know, commentators discussing it or experts giving their voice, just like you mentioned Graham Smith after Telford Wise case, we have Harbhajan Singh who's criticizing Ravichandran Ashwin on air, which is a bit odd, because, you know, that's the ex-off spinner of India criticizing the current off spinner of India. My point here is, he's not done worse than any other Indian spinner overseas. He's not done it. You cannot say he has not played against the best Australian sides, the best English sides. He can only play against the sides he can play. He can only play in conditions that he can play, the overseas conditions. So he's not done worse than any other Indian spinner. And yet, he seems to be the one who's regularly beaten with that stick of overseas statistics. That's my take, really. And that's a battle of perception you sometimes cannot win.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely the case. I mean, I think it was it Johnny Bairstow when Michael Vaughan went a bit mad on Twitter during the World Cup. I think Johnny Bairstow said, you know, these people are paid to have an opinion. And, you know, they can get it wrong as much as the rest of us. Just because you played international cricket doesn't mean that your opinions will always be spot on. So I think you've got something there. There is a battle of perception you cannot win, no matter if you're Bradman or anyone else.
Talking enough about Indian bowlers and batters, let's focus on South African batting. I thought they were absolutely brilliant, especially the senior pros in Dean Elgar and Fab Du Plessis to start off with. And then Quinton de Kock. I mean, these three showed how I think it needs to be. You need to bat here in the subcontinent with a lot of grit. Yes, de Kock came and showed his natural flair as well, but was very, very impressive. And I think we did mention this before the start of this of the test match as well, that this South African batting lineup, at least to me, seems to have it in them to kind of bat through a day, bat through a couple of days, which is so important to be successful here in India. Because most of the other teams that I've noticed, they don't have enough batsmen who could do that. And if you look at this South African batting lineup, you have Dean Elgar, you have Faf du Plessis, Markram, if required, can do that. Temba Bavuma, Tunis De Bruyn. I mean, these guys know how to hang in there, I think. And I honestly wasn't surprised to see that fight back. What surprised me, obviously, was day five. But day three and four, the way South African batters batted, I thought they were very, very good. And I was expecting something like that to happen. Telford, your take on that?
Yeah, it was good to see from a South African perspective. You know, especially I keep harping on about 2015, but I think that series made some deep scars in South Africa's view of themselves as particularly as a batting side. And you know, for instance, this match, if you add up the total amount of overs in this game, it's such an improvement. It's already longer they spent at the crease in this match than they did for, you know, any of the matches in 2015. And I think that's a good sign. They proved to themselves that they can do it. We know that Dean Elgar can, you know, bat in all sorts of conditions and tough it out, and he showed that, and that was good to see. And then I think that probably had a lot to do with Virat Kohli delaying his declaration, was the prospect of, hang on, that Elgar fella is still there. So I think that was an important factor. And yes, also de Kock. De Kock's best attribute is that he doesn't think too much, and I don't mean that as an insult at all, but he simply plays. He plays in the moment, and I think that really does help. More South Africans could learn from that. You know, he simply does what needs to be done on the available evidence in front of him, and not thinking too much can be a wonderful gift for a cricketer, and I think he certainly has that. So that was good to see. Bavuma has real discipline. There is a debate in South African cricket at the moment as to whether Bavuma or Faf du Plessis should be batting at number four. And that debate can go in all sorts of ways. But yes, good to see the South Africans bat the way they did. The second innings was disappointing. Even that, I mean, that's their highest fourth innings total in India ever. So, you know, yes, the only thing that matters is whether you won or lost. But there were some positives for South Africa to take out of the way they batted in this game.
Faf du Plessis had a major hand in it, because 39 for 3, and then they lost Temba Bavuma quickly in the first innings, and then you had Faf coming to the crease, and say what you want about Quinton or Dean Elgar, yes, their experience matters, his experience matters, Quinton de Kock, like you said, really free-thinking, hard-hitting cricketer, but Faf is really the best test batsman in this side at the moment, and to me, it was like he's batting too low. Why shouldn't he be batting at number four? Why shouldn't he be batting at number three even? Because what really happened was the complexion of the innings changed. Suddenly, Dean Elgar, who was a little tentative on day two in the small passage of play, because obviously a lot of wickets were falling at the other end. But suddenly he was more confident. He was going for those big shots. He was going for those sixes. Why? Because he saw Faf going for those sixes and fours as well. So That sense of calm, that sense of comfortness or comfortable partnership that suddenly came to the crease. And it reminded me of what A.B. de Villiers used to bring to the crease. You know, as soon as A.B. used to come to the crease, obviously the aura is different. A.B. was in a league of his own. Faf is more conservative in that sense. But there was a sense of comfort that, okay, this passage of play, our best batsman is at the crease. And we are going to look to dominate this passage of play. And with Faf there, they did dominate those two sessions. Before that, all six sessions, South Africa had lost. And suddenly, it was Faf and Dean Elgar driving the innings forward. And that momentum they generated, Quinton de Kock with his counter-attacking 100, he just took on the bowlers on and, you know, got 100 in his first appearance in India. So that was for me, very interesting. Yes, Theunis de Bruin and Temba Bavuma are probably your bets for the future. But for this series, just for this series, Telford, why shouldn't Faf be batting at number 3?
It's South Africa are still talking about what to do about Jacques Kallis. So, you know, they're still stuck in that bubble. So, I mean, he came up the other day, didn't he, in Faf du Plessis' comments. So, South Africa's batting order is an unsettled place. And as with other things, they're undercurrents. And why Temba Bavuma is batting at 4, for instance. And, you know, Chetan, you've been to South Africa enough times to know that there's a lot more than cricket that goes on with our cricket team. There's a lot of politics at play.
Yeah.
And you know, and there are those kinds of factors. We can't run away from them. It's an important thing to have a black African batsman batting that high up. And so it puts extra pressure on him. Of course it does. But it's a factor which has to be taken into account. And that is one of the reasons is, you know, I mean, Bavuma's 100 against England at Newlands a few years ago was not a great 100. And it came with a fine enough innings, but there wasn't a lot of pressure on him. But it was hailed as this major, major breakthrough milestone in the history of South African cricket. And that's the kind of subplot that you're dealing with all the time. So that's one of the reasons why Bavuma batted 4. Another reason, as Du Plessis said the other day, he has one of the best techniques that they have available to them. What he needs to find now is the other gear to actually make it count and to go forward and to get the runs that you've worked so hard for. Du Plessis, of course, he's the bridge between, you know, the attackers and the defenders, and he's very good at that. So I think the South African team still hasn't worked themselves out. I mean, they've lost, never mind Jacques Kallis, they've lost, as we said, de Villiers, they've lost Hashim Amla, and they haven't worked it out for themselves, you know, how best to do this thing. There is an argument and there is a debate and there is a discussion for Du Plessis to move up the order. And who knows, it may yet happen. I think there's more chance of them rearranging the batting order than there is actually of making any changes to the 11. You know, so there's that kind of discussion. It's a tactical discussion in terms of that 11, because that 11, even though they got smacked by 200 runs, didn't do that badly. They did a lot better than a lot of South Africans expected them to. So it's an interesting, you know, time for South Africa right now. They're not terribly sure how to go forward, but they're happy that they didn't go that far backwards.
If I may jump in, and you know, in my opinion, I think Faf is perfect at 4, Temba Bavuma at 5. If you leave aside off the field issues, which Telford has mentioned, I think from cricketing perspective, you have Theunis de Bruin, who looks good. He's more comfortable against the fast bowlers, it seems. But he's got 100 in Colombo against Sri Lanka. So obviously, he's good against spin as well. But I would really like to see Faf at number 4 and Bavuma at 5. Telford, did he not bat at 5 when he got that 100 at Newlands?
Yes, he did. Absolutely. So it's he's certainly done that, but there's a lot of symbolism at play here, and I'm afraid you can't leave aside the off-field issues. You know, they come with you onto the field in South Africa. So there is that kind of it's that kind of history that you're dealing with. But I think we may well see something like that. We may well see Faf at 4 and Temba at 5. I think that is a lot more likely than too many changes to the 11.
Well, we have issues of our own making here in Indian cricket as well. I mean, Telford, obviously they are not political or color based, but there are issues of perception, because Deep, 7 wickets in that South African innings, is Ashwin now the number one spinner? Because hold on, in February it was Kuldeep Yadav the number one spinner, but he didn't play in West Indies, and Jadeja played, Ashwin didn't play, so that was Jadeja the number one spinner. Now, Jadeja has been out-bowled by Ashwin on his comeback. 315 wickets in 66
days. I've lost you. Chetan, I've lost you. I've lost you already.
So three number one spinners in 9 months. What really is happening here?
Come on, that tells you about the depth of the Indian side, isn't it? Look at the positive side.
That's a good way of looking at it.
So you've got three number one spinners in the Indian side. But listen, to be honest, I mean, for me, Ravindra would be my number one choice as of now. I'd go with him if I have to play only one spinner, especially in the absence of Hardik Pandya. Because what he's shown in the last 6-8 months, that you can depend on him as an all-rounder, as a proper all-rounder. That's number one. I think Ashwin, the other thing is, listen, for me, he plays every time you play in the subcontinent or you play in India especially, you have to pick him. And even overseas, I can understand India going with one spinner in South Africa in 2018, because those pitches were very, very seamer-friendly pitches. I can understand picking just one spinner there. But I don't understand picking one spinner in West Indies. I'd actually would more often than not look at picking two spinners in the playing 11, unless you're actually playing on absolute green tops. So I'd still go with Ashwin and Jadeja at this point in time. I know it's a little unfair on Kuldeep, because whatever limited opportunities that Kuldeep's got in Test match cricket, he's done well. Whether it's in India or in Australia, he's shown that he can still be very effective. And what it also does, unfortunately for someone like Kuldeep, he's had a pretty struggling last 9-odd months, be it T20, one day, and now Test matches. So I don't know how that will affect him mentally as well, because he was, like you said, your number one choice. He was your regular all three format bowler not too far back, and suddenly he doesn't find a place in the playing 11 in either of those formats now.
Right, so it's not just the battle of perception for Ashwin. The other battle of perception, and we just brushed on that a bit, was Rohit Sharma, because twin hundreds in this test match. Has he done enough to, again, Telford, here again, we have that overseas question, because India, well, they are traveling to New Zealand, Australia, England and South Africa by 2021. There was a gentleman from South Africa who tweeted to me, and he was like, I'm very interested in seeing Rohit Sharma open in South Africa. And I was like, I replied to him like, listen, India are coming to South Africa last this time. They'll be coming in December 2021. We have New Zealand before that. We have Australia before that. We have England before that. If Rohit Sharma comes to South Africa as opener, he would have done well as opener.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I remember we were talking about Virender Sehwag a little earlier. Virender Sehwag came to South Africa. And all I remember is that I think there was a third or fourth ball he faced. He ended up slicing a catch to third man at Centurion. Rohit Sharma is going to be able to play the same way in South Africa, but I'm very wary of pigeonholing players, and I would hope that he has the intelligence to be able to adjust his game and find a way to succeed in conditions like this. But yeah, you're absolutely right, Chetan. If he's still opening the batting for India, by the time India come here, he will have done very, very well, and I'm sure he will have learnt a lot about his game, and of course in varying conditions. So it'll be interesting to see. We'll have to get out the highlights reels of the Vizag test, if that is the case.
I think we'll only figure out once India starts traveling, isn't it?
Yes,
I mean, at this
point
in time, what you have is you're playing South Africa here in India, and you can only judge him based on his performance in what's given to him. What's given to him is India and South Africa. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, we'll see when India starts traveling, and we'll cross the bridge when we reach it. I mean, a lot of people have been saying that on social media and all, we'll see when he starts traveling. I mean, yes, we will see that. But as of now, let's appreciate the fact that somebody scored a 100 in both the innings. Apart from Mr. Gavaskar, nobody else has done as an Indian opener. No one else. If it was that easy against any bowling attack in India, I'm sure there would have been a few more openers doing that, isn't it? I mean,
absolutely.
Rohit being only the second opener to do it, I mean, you've got to give him credit for what he's achieved. And yes, overseas, he might need to change a few of, bit of his technique and mindset and everything else. I'm sure he will do that, because what I initially said, I think he is taking this opportunity very, very seriously. Otherwise, somebody who's well established, a 32, 33 year old, you can say one of the top batsman in white ball cricket. You would very rarely see people like that, players like that, changing their technique to get into the test side or kind of accommodate their technique according to test match cricket. And somebody like Rohit doing that just tells me that, you know, he is going to give it a really, really good shot.
Right. It's all about bridges and crossings at the moment. You have Philander fighting a battle of perception, Ashwin fighting a battle of perception, and Rohit Sharma fighting a battle of perception. As we move on towards the final segment of this episode, it needs to be highlighted here, gentlemen, that the way Rohit batted and the way Pujara batted, Rohit had two big partnerships in this test match. First one was really free-flowing. With Pujara, it was not perhaps as free-flowing. It's because the way Rohit batted in the second innings, India were able to delay that declaration, perhaps. Yes, Dean Elgar factor was there, Telford, but also because the Rohit Sharma factor was there, that they were able to push on those extra runs, get them extra quick, and get to that total of or setting a target of 395. We'll talk about the various aspects of South Africa's collapse and, of course, second innings Shami. Right, so continuing about and talking about second innings Shami, Telford, remember him from the first test in Cape Town, second test century, and third test Johannesburg. Well versed with second innings Shami, but first of all, without Rohit Sharma, India wouldn't have got those 400.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing when you have a batsman who you can count on to accelerate things, you know, and just to break the mold as to how this strange game we call Test cricket should go forward and accelerate. So that's a great thing to have for somebody like Virat Kohli to be able to factor into things. And yes, absolutely. As much as Dean Elgar might have been a factor in the declaration, I'm sure the way that Sharma batted and the way Kohli knew he could bat was a major consideration. And then Shami, yes, it's a wonderful thing. I love it when a bowler comes, or any kind of, you know, any discipline of player goes out of their comfort zone and performs. It's a great thing to see. I mean, and I people say, who do you support? I support no one except maybe the New York Yankees. So I don't really care who wins. And it's great to see when someone comes out of their bubble, you know, to South Africa, where, you know, Indians are not supposed to be able to play well, which is a load of hogwash anyway. And it's good to see that. I like to see that those skills transferred across the world and to different conditions. I'm going to be especially happy when a South African spinner goes to India and takes a bag full of wickets. That'll be a good thing to see.
Yeah, that'll be the day. We'll probably wash off some more memories of 2015. We've spoken about that enough. Deep, if I tell you that Shami almost has the same number of wickets in the first innings as he does in the second innings in Test cricket, would you believe that?
I think I saw that stat somewhere, so I would actually believe that. But yeah, listen, Shami, you know what? I actually believe that if he had been a little more aware of the fitness issues that he's had or all that stuff, maybe 5-6 years back, listen, he would have finished his career at 350 plus wickets for sure. Because the skill level that he has, I've seen him when he was a 17-year-old. I've seen him since. I was a selector of Bengal when he started playing first-class cricket. Right. And I just felt for the longest time that he himself did not realize how good he was, or he is rather. And the skill set that is gifted to him, this is a natural gift. He's only started working really hard from, say, 2017 onwards. You know, when the team got into this, the whole thing, when Anil came in, Ravi was there, then Virat backed him, the whole team management backed him. They kind of wrapped him up in a cotton wool and said, you know what, you play these games, you don't play these games. Have you ever heard that the Indian team management has called the first class side and said, you know what, he's not going to bowl more than 15 overs in a game? And that's how they've treated someone like Shami. And he's delivered because he's so good. I mean, his seam position is the best in the world, I would reckon, at this point in time. He gets close to the stump. That's the reason he kind of bowls so straight and makes almost every ball hit the stump. I mean, that's what you need. And that's one of the reasons why he's so good in the second innings, because he's so straight. He gets close to the stump. He pulls wicket to wicket. And he makes the batsman play almost every delivery. And on a fourth or a fifth day pitch, when it's going to be a little up and down, well, he's definitely going to be more successful than the other bowlers.
You just, you know, when someone bowls, as Deep has said, you just keep yourself in the game. You give yourself more options. You know, there are too many bowlers who are bowling only for a catch behind and that kind of thing. But if, as Deep said, on the fourth and fifth day pitch, you know, when the pitch is going up and down, the bounce is unpredictable. Why wouldn't you do that? You know, stop bowling for catches behind. Bowl at the stumps, for goodness sake.
Absolutely. I'm just going to come back to you, Telford, on that up down conversation. But Deep, I would like to mention here, I was on that tour to West Indies where Sami made his comeback to Test cricket, and he raved and raved about how he was treated at the NCA in terms of fitness. His fitness was brought back. He was given every support possible by the team management, by the BCCI, by the trainers. Yeah. Shankar Basu he mentioned, and Shankar Basu, who was the ex-Indian trainer, Indian team's trainer, he mentioned that Shami is his biggest achievement. A fit Shami is his biggest achievement, really. And, you know, it's been a sea change.
Telford and Chetan, both of you, I think from Shami's point of view, his biggest achievement is the fact that he does not have biryani anymore. You know, he's just one guy who would have biryani breakfast, lunch and dinner, if possible even a snack. So for him to be actually, I mean, credit to him. And also all this on the things that has happened off the field last couple of years, what he's been through, it's not been easy for him off the field as well. I mean, I think that also kind of helped him get his perspective of what he is all about, what is expected of him, where he stands in his career at this point in time. I think a lot of things have happened with him in the last couple of years, good and bad, that is kind of culminated into where he is right now, what he's doing right now.
Absolutely. I mean, when these things happen, you realize what you love most. And he spoke about his love for cricket in Birmingham last year. And as for the chicken biryani thing, I absolutely believe you. Whenever I go on tour covering the Indian team, I see Mohammad Shami and Ridhiman Saha at an Indian restaurant. Maybe not lunch, but every day for dinner. But for the last two overseas tours, I don't know about the West Indies tour, I wasn't there. But in Australia and in England, I did not spot Shami at any Indian restaurant. So I can vouch for that. And look, when a man gives up good food, gives up chicken biryani, you know he's serious about fitness. He's serious about fast bowling. Telford, you mentioned the up and down thing. Were you surprised that the pace of Shami did that damage? And was it the biggest surprise that perhaps South Africa thought that day five demons would come out against spin, and they were caught unawares by Shami's wonderful bowling?
I think before I answer that, I have to say that I love biryani much more than cricket. So I would never be able to do a Shami. I think the South Africans were probably pleasantly surprised by how the demons were demons they understood. You know, and they weren't the kind of demons that they have seen in the past on Indian pitches. Faf du Plessis made a point of saying it was a fine pitch. You know, it behaved. It was in the paradigm of South African understanding of a cricket pitch, and so there was certainly no way that they could blame the pitch or cast any kind of aspersions on it. I don't think they were surprised. I mean, we have to just give the credit where it's due. Shami is a fine bowler, and he bowled magnificently. You know, and the pitch helped him as it should. On day five, that's only fair, and I think that's essentially it. You know, South Africa were beaten by a better team playing better cricket than they were, even though South Africa's cricket was better than we have seen in the past. But the fact is, India deserved to win, and it's got nothing to do with the conditions. Their batsmen and bowlers performed better than South Africa's. I don't think the South Africans were particularly surprised. Perhaps they were surprised at how much better they played than maybe they thought they would. So, you know, that I think is the only surprise in all this. And well done to India. They deserve their victory.
And just continuing on that, Telford, your thoughts on what, I mean, we've discussed Faf and you mentioned that maybe they won't change the side. Looking ahead to the second test, what do you think South Africa need to change? And do you think they will change it?
What I think they need to change is perhaps, you know, I've said that I don't think we're going to see large changes in the 11, but I think they could benefit by putting another fast bowler in there and leaving out one of the spinners. Who that might be, considering the spinners propped up their batting quite well, is a difficult question to answer. But I think they need to do that, perhaps. And then they just need to, you know, just show more of the application that they started showing. There were too many unfinished jobs in both of those innings, you know. You know, they showed that they can play in India. They need to now take their minds off the conditions and just play what's in front of them. I think if more of them played like de Kock, I think that would be a good idea. There's no way you can really replicate that. But just stop thinking and play. You know, I think a lot of cricketers will get much more out of their games if they simply did that. I know it's difficult to do that, especially when you're up against a fine team and that's not easy. But I think that is really the key. Stop thinking and do.
Right. Deep, can you and I agree that India will not be making any changes and there is perhaps no need for making changes?
There's no need, and it'll be very unfair on anyone you drop right now. I mean, and on what basis? There have been calls of getting another spinner in for Hanuma. I mean, come on, give this guy a break. He's been so good. It's just a couple of innings. He hasn't scored too many, and people are talking about dropping him. So, yeah, I mean, I don't see any changes in the playing 11. I'd be extremely surprised if there is. And especially Pune. I mean, mind you, Pune, again, generally, it does help the spinners, which it will. But again, we've got to remember, this is start of the season here in India. So most of the pitches will be pretty good to bat on. It will not be ranked turners because none of the association would want to risk their own domestic season by preparing a ranked turner right in the beginning of a season. So I don't see ranked turners in this series at all. The pitch will be good for batting like it was at Vizag.
Well, the only issue is that from what I've heard is that there's been a lot of rain in and around Pune for the last couple of weeks. And perhaps the groundsmen have not had the chance to prepare the pitch. That's not something that South Africa would want to hear. But also like to mention that Pune were warned the last time there was a test match there. We had India-Australia in 2017. And that match finished in 2.5 days. Telford, really, fingers crossed, this test match not getting over in 2.5 days?
Well, I also need to point out that Australia won that test match. So.
Yes, absolutely. And they played three spinners.
Exactly. So let's not take that metaphor too far, perhaps, from an Indian point of view.
Right. Well, that was this week's episode of Hotspot. A comprehensive win for India. 160 points from 160 available in the World Test Championship so far. South Africa yet to get off the mark, but let's hope that they can fight back and get off to some points at least in this World Test Championship, in this series as well. Won't it make for compelling viewing? Well, we'll be back next week after the second test in Pune with another episode of Hotspot. We would like to thank you for joining us and listening to us. And also thanks to Telford for taking time and joining us all the way from Cape Town. Telford, the next time you're in town in India, chicken biryani on us.
Absolutely. Sold.
In the meantime, do leave your feedback and comments. Share it on social media. Reach out to us on social media as well. We are now on Apple iTunes, Spotify and TuneIn. So you can subscribe to this podcast on Cricket Hotspot there as well. Until next week, goodbye.
Finishes off in style. A magnificent strike into the crowd. India lift the World Cup after 28 years.